Hey there, fourth trimester listeners. Our program today is proudly sponsored by Family Album, your secure haven for sharing baby photos and videos. Head over to the App Store today, search Family Album, one word, download the app, and start creating a legacy of love, one photo at a time. Hi, I'm Sarah Trott, and welcome to the Fourth Trimester Podcast. I'm a new mama, and this podcast is all about postpartum care for the first few months following birth, the time period also known as the fourth trimester. My postpartum doula, Esther Gallagher, is my co-host. She's a mother, grandmother, perinatal educator, birth and postpartum care provider. Fourth trimester care, our topic, is about the practical, emotional, and social support parents and baby require. And importantly, it helps set the tone for the continuing journey of parenting. Hi, this is Sarah Trott, and welcome back to the Fourth Trimester Podcast. We have a special guest today. Our topic is about newborn brain development, wiring your baby's brain for success through the optimal brain development, and the importance of that serve and return during the first year of life. I'm going to introduce my guest in a moment. And before I do, I'd like to let you know that we have a website, which is fourthtrimesterpodcast.com. It's packed with great information on all of our episodes, as well as deals from partners that we have. So check those out. It's fourthtrimesterpodcast.com/deals. And then you can also look at all of the freebies and resources that we have for you that we've collected over the years. So we highly recommend going there if you haven't seen that yet. And now I'm going to talk about our topic and our guest. So like I said, we're talking about optimal newborn brain development. We're going to talk about how the brain develops, what parents can do practically to optimize that development, the serve and return interaction concept, and example routines and rituals that you can implement right away with your newborn during this first year of life and beyond. And our guest today is Rebecca Walsh. So she has been on our show before. Welcome back, Rebecca.
Thank you so much, Sarah. It's so wonderful to be back.
Yes. So I'm going to give you a little bit of an intro, Rebecca. So Rebecca has an extensive background in education and early childhood development. She has over 20 years experience in early childhood education. She has a bachelor's degree in child development and a master's degree in religion and psychology. She's held lots of senior positions as a teacher and mentor and educator. And she also is a female founder. Her own business is called Early Childhood Matters, and she creates and leads education programs there. We love those courses. Please go to her website, Early Childhood Matters, and we'll link to it on the website on the article that goes with the show. Her last episode that she recorded with us on fourth trimester is episode 96. It's all about mom groups. Why? Because she is the queen of mom groups. She has created many and led many over the years. I have participated in her mom groups. They are brilliant, specifically her second time moms group, which is a whole other set of topics versus the first time around. So definitely listen to episode 96. It's called the Mom Group Guide. I also have to mention that she's a mom. She has three children of her own, and Rebecca is incredibly credentialed and experienced, a very humble and compassionate teacher. So thank you so much for coming back to be on our program, Rebecca.
Oh, thank you again, Sarah, for having me. It's so wonderful to be here and to be a part of Fourth Trimester, which is really just offering so many amazing resources to parents in this very critical and often isolating time, right after that baby is born. And to have these resources available is just amazing. So I'm really excited to be a part of this.
Thank you. Yes. Well, so let's dive right in. I'm so excited to talk about this topic. This first year of life is such a tender time, and there are a lot of different ideas about what that could or could not look like. But I'm sure that a lot of parents like me, you know, were very interested in thinking about how to optimally support and help my baby develop during that first year of life. And so we're talking about both the EQ, emotional, and the IQ, intellectual development of the brain. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I am so excited to talk about this topic. It is something that I'm just so passionate about. And I really believe that everybody should know about this. So putting this information out here to more parents is so critical. I think everybody that ever graduates from a university should have this knowledge. Everybody that graduates from high school should have this knowledge. Everybody that has a baby should absolutely be given this information about just what happens in that first year of life, right? Like what happens from a brain development perspective? How is the brain built? So we're going to try to answer those two questions in this episode. Why is the first year so important for the potential of the human brain? And secondly, how is that brain built exactly?
Yeah. And we all are humans with a brain. So it seems like this might be so critical for everyone to understand. I couldn't agree with you more. Let's shout it from the rooftops.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, doctors, politicians, economists, mental health professionals, literally everybody should be talking about this. So let's go. I really think it's the most important and direct way to transform the world. This is what I think.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. Why?
I mean, basically in the first year of life, you are literally building human potential. I kind of just have to pause there. Like we're building human potential in the first year of life. And the whole architecture of the brain is going to be formed by these early interactions and this responsive environment and responsive relationship. And really what's interesting is this is kind of cutting edge as far as realizing the importance of actually that first year. So we've known the importance of the first 5 years. We've known for a while, and some of your listeners may not know this still, but we know that 90% of the brain develops by the age of five. I knew I always wanted to work with children and families, and myself came from an environment with a lot of adversity, and a lot of my friends, neighbors had even more adversity than I did. And so knowing that, I really wanted to work with children and families, and I knew I wanted to be in that space from a pretty early age. And when I went to college, I wasn't sure if I wanted to go into teaching, if I wanted to be a therapist, a school counselor. I was still kind of figuring it out. And I remember going to the child development department and they were giving their little spiel. And I always loved young children anyway. They were my favorite to babysit was that preschool age. So I went to check it out, and I'll never forget my professor at the time, well, future professor at the time who became a mentor, Dr. K. She said in the spiel, in the speech, well, 90% of the brain develops by the age of five. So if you want to make an impact in the world, please join the child development department. And I was sold. I mean, I was absolutely sold because, you know, I had seen that so much in my life over and over, where you have children who are in kindergarten, who are in first grade, and teachers that are, you know, doing amazing work with these children. But you notice that they're already struggling. They're already behind, right? We have the achievement gap studies. We have the word gap studies. Like we know, and now we know even more. But anyway, that's kind of what drew me to the field was that piece of knowledge. 90% of the brain develops by the age of five. So if we're going to really make an impact, this is the time. So since then, what started to be emphasized, I would say in the last like 10 to 15 years even, is this idea of the first 3 years being so impactful. And we know that really the limbic system or the emotional center of the brain is almost fully developed by the age of three. There's a little restructuring that happens in adolescence, but basically the whole structure of the brain is developed by the age of three, the structure of the limbic brain. So that was kind of, okay, so now we know first three. But then pretty recently, I would say, we've learned that it's the first year is actually when the architecture or the foundation for that limbic system is pretty much set into motion. First year.
Wow. I mean, that's a lot to fathom and wrap the head around. So can you break that down even a little bit further? I mean, the human potential formed in that first year?
Yeah. I know, it's mind-blowing. Like, and again, this is why, you know, we all sort of need to understand this. But basically, the brain builds from the bottom up, right? So the stronger the foundation is, the more potential for this higher functioning brain to be built upon it. I mean, it's kind of like if you were to hire a contractor to come to your house and let's say you wanted to, I'd love to expand my attic and maybe put some rooms up there, right? Or, you know, I would love to do like a little deck off the top floor. Or, you know, we're thinking about moving our kitchen up to the top and bringing the bedrooms down, or, you know, anything that you're doing, you're adding weight, you're adding load bearing on that top floor. The first thing that contractor, that engineer is going to be looking at is your foundations, right? Number one, can the foundation support this work in the attic, this work for that added floor or structure? So the brain is really similar. So that's just kind of a really good like visual way to think about it. So basically, if that foundation is strong, then the rest of the brain can literally be built upon it, right? And then that leads to that higher functioning. And when we're talking about brain development, unlike a house, right, we're talking about potential for intellectual, like you said, EQ, IQ, all of that.
Got it. So higher functioning, you've got your foundation level. And then on top of that, you've got the limbic, the more of the EQ. And then on top of that is the intelligence.
Yeah, exactly. So again, brain builds from the bottom up. So really, it starts in utero, right? So if we're going to look at policies to support children and families and essentially society, right? If we want to transform society by getting to a brain that has this really strong prefrontal cortex. So that's one thing that we can think about and start with is like end goal, right? So end goal would be brains that have this really healthy, very interconnected cerebral cortex. The cerebral cortex is that last part of the brain to develop. Some of you may know it's not fully developed till 25. But that part of the brain is what codes for really essential things to be, I mean, everything from being a functional, productive member of society to being, you know, an altruistic member of society. So that cerebral cortex is going to code for all of your basic executive function skills. It's going to code for things like, you know, really primarily self-control. So the ability to have an emotion or a feeling and not act on it immediately, but be able to exhibit some self-control and some inhibition, right? So the other thing that we're thinking about when we think of executive function or you know, what comes to mind for you, right? Like when you think of executive function, I would say.
I mean, I would be thinking about that intelligence, like the, you know, the person who's in charge of managing every function of the body, the movement of our body, the decisions, the speaking, the things that we're saying in our thinking. It's very much our thinking brain.
Yeah, exactly. So that's that cerebral brain. And then that highest brain, which isn't developed till fully 25, is like that problem solving brain, right? So that brain that is able to use past experiences to mitigate our current behavior or future behavior. So it's a planning brain. It's basically, you think of it as the brain that makes us human, that separates us from the rest of the mammalian world, right? So we're able to predict, we're able to plan, we're able to problem solve, we're able to think about things in the future. So again, thinking about these things and thinking about the other big thing that final part of the brain is responsible for is literally compassion. So that is something that we don't see in the animal kingdom. We see a lot of empathy in the animal kingdom, right? Like if you have a dog and you're kind of feeling sad, the dog may notice and come over and just kind of give you a cuddle. But when you're, let's say you have like a cut on your finger, the dog isn't able to think, oh, gee, they have a cut. I probably will just, you know, wait for my food. I know they're trying to feed me, but I'm going to wait because I see that, you know, they're hurting. And I bet you that feels a lot like how when I was out at the park the other day and I stepped on something and cut my foot. Like a dog's not going to be able to do that. A dog is like, feed me, feed me, feed me. Oh, you're cut? Like, I can't think of anything else, right? So you think about a human, and again, not all humans are able to do something like that, but a human being able to kind of put their own needs aside for a second and think about somebody else, right? It's a very higher functioning. And this, if you can imagine a world where everybody has this potential to problem solve, to not act on impulses, right? That has a world where everybody is able to, you know, have compassion for others, who a world where people are able to use logical thinking and reason before making decisions, that are able to think about the future, right? I mean, there's so many implications of this. And this is why I say, like, the greatest impact economically, socially, on so many levels that we can have is really to make sure that these brains are developing to their fullest potential.
Yes, amazing.
Literally, like, that's all we're talking about is, can we give everybody in life the opportunity for their brains to develop to their fullest potential? So yeah, so that's kind of the long and the short of it. And like I said, you know, so that's like the prefrontal cortex, and it starts in utero, you know, just basic, because each section of the brain is dependent on the other. And when you have this brainstem, then that's the only part of the brain developed in utero. And so that brainstem, or that kind of reptilian brain, you know, well, basic things like abstaining from drugs and alcohol are going to lead to the potential of the brainstem. Also, like, healthy nutrition during pregnancy. So during pregnancy is when that first part of the brain develops, which will impact, however that develops, will impact the limbic brain. And then however the limbic brain develops will impact the cerebral brain. So all the things that you were talking about, like the ability to control movement, the ability to use language, the ability to use logic, the ability to do, you know, advanced math, all of that is in that cerebral. And then that prefrontal cortex is that final part that really separates us and allows us to have self-control and compassion. But yeah, in utero, we've got, you know, we're taking our prenatal vitamin. We know how important now, like, things we didn't know before, right? Like how important folic acid is. So much research on fish oil and how that can help myelinate those brain cells and help them come together, right? So those are the things you can think about prenatally, and basic, you know, abstaining from drugs and alcohol. Those are the kind of those basic things. And next comes that limbic. So as soon as the baby is born, what we're doing is we are starting to develop the limbic brain. We are literally wiring the limbic brain from the moment the child smells us for the first time, the moment they feel the warmth of our body. They're already moving from the reptilian world, which never feels the warmth of their mother's body, right? A reptile hatches from the egg and is 100% good to go. And they don't need that other part of the brain to develop in order to survive. The way that a reptile is coded is that they just need the survival instincts. They need to be able to eat, hunt, you know, fight or flight, da, da, da. And that's all they need. Now, a baby obviously will not survive without human care and connection. So that's kind of this first part, is how do we set up this limbic brain to reach its fullest potential so that the cerebral brain and the prefrontal cortex can then reach their potential. So one of the things we know about incarceration is that about 98% of people who are incarcerated had trauma, abuse, and neglect before the age of 3.
That's hard. That's a really sad statistic.
Yeah. And what we're thinking about is how their brain was wired differently, right? So that limbic brain not coming together and not being able to support things like self-control, things like impulse control, right? Things like ration and reason and all of those things. So we know how important this is.
Rebecca, I have to step in and ask, but that's not to say that if someone has experienced some of those things and then later in life, they're still as children, that doesn't mean you'll be incarcerated. It's very much worth going back and addressing and helping create that sense of connectivity, that sense of care that's so critical for brain development.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, and we have a lot. Yeah, no, thank you for clarifying. No. It's more just looking at that statistic and saying, what does that say about how things maybe didn't come together for this child, how things were not available to support this child's human potential, right? But absolutely, we have, you know, a lot of resiliency studies. And, you know, depending on the environment, there's millions and millions of children that have experienced some level of trauma, abuse, neglect that are 100%, you know, functioning and successful adults. Yeah, no. But one of the interesting studies that I wanted to highlight was actually that, you know, if you look at, for example, domestic violence, and there's a really interesting study that was done by CASA, which is an advocate for foster care children. And they did this longitudinal study and found that children that witnessed domestic violence in the first year versus in, you know, they looked at children who had witnessed domestic violence between 0 and 1, 3 to 5, 1 to 3, 3 to 5, 5 to 7, and then, you know, 8+. And so you're thinking about an 8-year-old, a 13-year-old, you're thinking about a 1-year-old, a 2-year-old, and then you're thinking about an infant, right? A 0 to 1. And the children that had the largest outcomes, negative outcomes, socially, cognitively, emotionally, were, believe it or not, children that had witnessed domestic violence in that first year of life.
Wow. Wow, that's interesting. That's not necessarily what I would have thought.
Right? I mean, most people don't, because you think, well, that baby will probably be okay. At least they won't remember.
Yeah. I've heard that before, the baby won't remember comment, not necessarily in relation to domestic violence or those other like abuse situations, but just in relation to whatever everyday things that are happening.
Yeah. So let's debunk that a little bit. Yeah. So the baby won't remember. I mean, it is 100% true that we do not have cognitive memories. Usually earliest is around 2. Most people, it's more like between 3 and 4 is their earliest memory. But some people can have their earliest memories being between 2 and 3. Okay. So it is 100% true that your baby is never going to, as an adult, say, oh, I remember that time when blah, 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 blah happened. And when I was 7 months old. Nope, not possible. Why? Because that part of the brain isn't fully developed until that second or third year of life. Okay, hippocampus, right? So that part of the brain hasn't wired together yet. Okay, so true fact. But unfortunately, what is more true is that their body will remember and the structure of their brain will be changed and shaped more dramatically by any events in that first year. Because again, first year of life, we have a million synaptic connections per second. Everything is coming together. Everything is wiring. And your brain is literally being told how to code. And the more connections in that limbic system, again, greater potential for these higher functioning. So yeah, they won't remember it, but their brain will be changed by it.
Yeah, that's so fascinating.
Yeah. But I also want to be clear with listeners that like, and we're going to now go into like, what is this that we're talking about? Like, how do we create these synaptic connections? How do we get a dense limbic system, which is what we're after? The denser the limbic system, the more potential the cerebral and prefrontal cortex has for development. So we're going to talk about that. But I want to start by just saying like, this is really something we're looking at over the first year of life. This is not like a second by second, day by day, hour by hour kind of thing. We're looking at responsive caregiving and a responsive, you know, least toxic environment possible in that first year of life. So if you're in, you know, day 16 and you're, you know, if you're in month 2 of a newborn and you're exhausted and you're stressed and you're tired and you're overwhelmed and you're not getting much sleep, like this is not going to impact your baby's brain development. Okay. We're talking about a responsive, loving relationship that's going to develop over the first year. And in fact, there's more and more studies showing that many women don't develop a bond with their babies right away, that it is a much slower process than Hollywood or movies or, you know, Hallmark cards would lead us to believe. So, or Instagram, right? That many women and dads for that take time to develop that bond. And so that is really normal. So I want to, you know, just preface when we talk about like brain building ways, just preface it by saying it's okay if it feels a little slower in the beginning. 100% okay.
So in other words, don't stress it if you aren't 100% paying close attention to this aspect of your baby's development 24/7. In other words, you're saying it's okay to take a balanced approach and take care of yourself.
Oh, yes, 100%. And let's talk about what that looks like. But basically, right now, in this first 3 or 4 months, the only thing that really is important is that as much as you can, responding to the baby's needs, right? So when the baby cries, are they being picked up? When they're hungry, are they being fed? Lots of research on feeding on demand. This is why pediatricians recommend it. There, if we want to do some other myth busting. Yeah, so there's a book that was completely debunked by medical science and medical world. And it's, I cannot believe that parents are still using it after it's been basically linked to a failure to thrive, an infant, even some deaths. And it's this, you know, basically very strict schedule of not feeding on demand, of feeding on a schedule. And that, you know, they should only feed every 3 or 4 hours. They should never, you know, pick up a child if they're hungry. They should never feed them in between, you know, all of this. And again, it's been completely debunked. And I'm very surprised. Even I talked to families and, you know, very well educated families in San Francisco that are still following this book. So we'll definitely link that in the notes. But basically, that's the most important thing I would say in those first few months is just, you know, talking to your doctor. And every baby may have slightly different needs, but, you know, when they cry, when they're hungry, are they being fed? Are they being nurtured? Right. And again, if you're really tired and stressed out and you can't always do that, it's okay, because this is going to be something that the baby learns. This trust that they're learning is really over that first year or even the first 18 months. But it is like, and we should, you know, take a moment. I know you have a lot of resources for postpartum depression, and you've had episodes on this as well. Just to say, like, if you're feeling like this is more serious, it is really important to get the care and to get the support that you need to be able to take breaks from your baby, to be able to feel connected and close. And if you have, you know, postpartum depression or anxiety that is getting in the way, it's certainly important from a developmental perspective that you reach out and get the support.
Yeah, absolutely. We're big fans of Postpartum Support International here in the United States. There's a free phone number you can call and talk to someone anonymously and get resources that could help you. Talk to your doctor, talk to your friends or your partner, and make sure you get the help that you need. Thank you. Hey, fellow parents. Can we take a moment to reflect on the joyous chaos that is parenthood? You know those days when our hearts swell with love at the sight of our little ones and we're bursting at the seams to share every adorable moment with the world? But let's be real. Some things are better kept in the family, and your loved ones who matter the most aren't always close by, and they might not be that tech savvy either. So how can you easily share your baby's beautiful growth with loved ones while keeping your precious memories secure? I remember the frustration of trying to use some of the big tech photo solutions, only to find they fell short of what I needed. That's when I stumbled upon something truly remarkable, the Family Album app. The Family Album app was created to give parents a secure and easy way to share photos and videos with loved ones. It's an orderly and totally secure haven for your family's personal memories. I love that there's no third-party ads, no unwanted eyes, unlimited storage, and that it's totally free. So to all the parents who are out there still trying to use other messaging apps for your kids' photos, it's time to level up your family photo game with a free photo sharing app. Head over to the App Store today, search Family Album, one word, download the app, and start creating a legacy of love one photo at a time.
Yeah. So let's like shift gears a little bit and just like, so we kind of talked a lot about like what happens in the first year or what we know about why this first year is so important. And now let's like shift gears and talk more specifically about like, how do we get that density, right?
Yes. What leads to that optimal environment?
Right. So yeah, so it really is like, you kind of think of it in two ways, you know, one is environment and the other would be relationships. So as far as environment goes, what we're thinking about there is a least toxic environment, a least stressful environment. So obviously things that are going to be really stressful on a child are, you know, domestic violence, any kind of violence in the home, any kind of, you know, often just things like if parents are really stressed about, you know, food insecurity or housing insecurity, this is going to lead to, not always, right? Like, definitely not always, but it can lead to a less present parent if they're so caught up in these kinds of basic, their own survival basic needs, right? So that can lead to a more toxic environment. Those are some of the risk factors that we know. And by the way, if your listeners will link this as well, but if your listeners are interested, in addition to the course that we have on Famfully that we'll be talking about at the end, but a lot of this research is coming out of the Harvard Center on the Developing Child. And they have been conducting these longitudinal studies over the last 30 or 40 years. And they're kind of leading this brain science development. And in fact, about 5 years ago, they changed their website from saying 700 million or 700,000 synaptic connections per second to, oh no, we actually think it's 1 million synaptic connections per second in that first year. Meaning like the brain is forming and growing faster than we even thought it was. But anyway, they have some amazing resources to think about. But basically, you know, some of the risk factors that they're listing, you know, are things, you know, these big picture things like poverty and food insecurity, housing insecurity, and, you know, domestic violence, all of those things. And the other two and final critical things would be drug and alcohol abuse. So, and that makes a lot of sense, right? Like, obviously, if you have an addiction, it's very hard to be present to somebody else. It's hard to be available. So those are kind of those big picture things in the environment. But I think sometimes it can also, in our own environments, what can lead to is just, like I said, our own mental health, right? Getting the support that we need, and just the distractions as busy parents, right? So thinking about cell phone use as something in the environment that's sort of taking us away from the present with our child. And as we'll talk about, we're not talking about our children, our babies even need 100% of our attention all the time. In fact, a lot of research that shows that a little bit of stress in the context of a loving, connected environment and loving, connected relationships can have positive effects on the brain. So a little bit of stress, a little bit of crying, and, you know, then figuring out for themselves that, oh, actually, I got through that. I was okay, right? So those can be positive. But we're talking like big picture here. Is the relationship loving? Is it connected? And those are going to be the things that we really want to focus on.
Okay. And is this the serve and return concept that we were talking about earlier?
Yes. So as far as like, what does a healthy relationship look like, right? So scientists have kind of broken it down, and it's really interesting. You can actually, if you go on the Harvard Center for the Developing Child's website, they actually have videos where you can see where they film just people interacting with their children, and some grandparents, sometimes daycare providers, sometimes, you know, mothers, fathers, just interacting with their children. And what they highlight is in all of these videos, what they're noticing is that there's really high quality serve and return. So a basic way to analyze a healthy, loving relationship, what does that mean? Right? It seems kind of abstract and non-scientific, right? Although we should bring up one of the first, you know, studies, historical studies that highlighted this need for love and connection in babies was, you know, looking at Dr. Ed Tronick, who was brought into the orphanage crisis in the United States post-World War I. And the medical doctors at the time could not figure out why all of these babies were not surviving. They had really meticulous charts of all of their feeding, their diapers had been changed, they'd been fed. And this was going on in different parts of the world. But so there's a lot of different, very similar studies. But Dr. Henry Chaplin was the one in the US. And Henry Chaplin decided to go in and observe and to see what was going on. And when he does, he notices that the nurses, you know, they have like a 1-to-30 ratio, let's say. And so they're very overwhelmed and they're not talking to the babies. They're not connecting with them. They're just propping up the bottles. They're changing their diapers really quickly and they're moving on. And when he's interviewing them, by the way, Anna Pinkley did the same thing in Europe at the time, post-World War I Yugoslavian orphanage crisis. And Anna Pinkley did the same thing. And she's going, what's going on? Well, what they found was that what was going on was that the babies weren't attached to anyone. And basically, going back to Henry Chapin in the U.S., survival rate to the age of 2 in a U.S. orphanage was 0%.
That's heartbreaking to hear. Yeah. So babies are really reliant on that emotional, secure attachment with another person.
Yeah. And so that was the first time when the medical world like had their eyes opened around this stuff and was like, oh, and he actually says babies need love to survive. And so that was like, you know, revolutionizing. And, but anyway, going back to what we can do and what does that mean? I think what researchers are trying to figure out, what does a responsive, loving relationship look like? And so what they came up with was this idea of the serve and return, which is used in brain development studies for all kinds of different things, actually. But the serve and return in infant brain development is when an infant reaches out to a parent in two ways. So an infant reaches out to a parent or caregiver when they are stressed. That's a serve. If that stress serve is returned with comfort and closeness. Again, in those early days, you may not be able to make the baby stop crying no matter what you do, right? But 9 times out of 10, there may be that 10 time where you're just like, I can't, and I'm just going to leave the baby, and that's the safest thing for me to do. But 9 times out of 10, you're trying, right? You're holding, you're rocking, you're bouncing, you're doing all the things. So the baby is associating, when I'm stressed, somebody will be there for me. And again, that's going to be like the majority of the time, not every single time. And not even if it's a tiny bit of stress and they can recover on their own, that can be even healthy. But when they're really stressed, is someone there for me? So that's one kind of serve. The other kind of serve that's going to lead to this synaptic connections coming together is the connection serve. So this is like really simply like when a baby, you know, a young baby might be just noticing their hands for the first time, right? And, you know, sometimes, again, independent play, having them be on their own doing that can be wonderful. But when they're noticing their hands and then they look up to you, and they're kind of looking at you and they're kind of waiting for a response. Are you there to say, oh, you noticed your hands? Yeah, those are your hands. Oh, aren't they so wonderful? Isn't that amazing that you can move your hands, you know? And then as they get older, they're going to be pointing to things, right? And is somebody there to talk to them and tell them about what they're pointing to? To notice the different textures with them, to notice the different sounds with them, right? You can see when they hear a sound and they might turn their head, and is somebody there? On a very basic level, what we're talking about is somebody being there for your child, right? And so when we're thinking about a parent, we're talking about a daycare provider, a nanny, but it's somebody that the majority of the time, again, this is not 100% of the time. In fact, like I said, there's studies that suggest even if you had all that time in the world to be 100% attuned, it would maybe not be the healthiest thing. Certainly when we look at resiliency and independence. Okay, so it's not to say, but we're really talking about quality of interactions.
The quality of interaction, and specifically, so more often than not, in other words, not all the time, but more often than not, on the balance, we are returning, we're listening to for that stress, anxiety, or reaching out for help to show them that, hey, we're here for them when you're asking for that support. And then also helping them develop that strong sense of self-esteem and to know that they're interesting by responding when they're finding something interesting, which, by the way, as adults, like, you know, the curtains might not be that interesting, but of course, for that baby or that toddler, this could be hugely important. And so honoring their interest helps them to develop their self-esteem and helps them to develop their own sense of self and knowing that they are important. So I really love the way you broke that down into those categories.
Yeah. And that's something that, you know, we talk about in all of our classes is this idea of floor time and being one-on-one and present. And one of the role play scenarios that we do it asks, you know, what is a child learning when somebody is there kind of, what I tell a lot of parents with just really young children is just imitate what they're doing. So if your baby starts like picking up something and going like this, just pick up something and do the same. So again, like you said, that tells me as the baby that, wow, people like my ideas. I'm going to keep coming up with things. I'm going to keep exploring. Okay. Again, going back to those horrible orphanage studies, but like if nobody's doing that, I'm going to stop exploring. I'm going to stop being interested. And therefore that limbic system is not going to develop. And I am not a lizard. So I cannot survive past those first 2 years. I have to have a limbic system. And ultimately I have to have a cerebral system to survive. So when we think about that importance of just, you know, connecting, right? Being present, being in tune with the baby. And again, it doesn't have to be all the time. And I think, you know, obviously like a big distraction nowadays is our phones, right? And there is, you know, they say a phone is the equivalent of 20 people in the room. So you have about 20 other people that you're connecting to. On average, probably more than that, but like on average, it's about the, you know, 20 other people in the room. The only problem, that would be wonderful if a baby was in a room with 21 people. It would be amazing for that baby. And in fact, when we look at traditional societies, we know that the ratio of adult to children is 13 to 1. And now adults are considered 13 and over, but if you have any older cousins or teenagers around, you know that they can be incredibly connected and helpful with a baby. So we know that the ratio is about 13 to 1, and that is what we are kind of wired for, that much connection. So what we're noticing now is that this generation of the nuclear family, we're raising a generation of connection-deprived children. There's a deprivation of connection. And then you take that one person, you know, or if they're lucky, they might have two people that are assigned to them. And those two people are basically on the phone with 20 other people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we as adults know how that feels, right? To be trying to have a meaningful connection and then someone else is ignoring us to look at a screen feels terrible. It also feels terrible to our kids. It teaches them that they're not as important. And I heard someone say something like, it doesn't make them like us less or love us less as caregivers. It just makes themselves feel less worthy.
Oh,
I know. Yeah. I know. It's so hard.
Taking all that and self-care and all of that. So my biggest recommendation would be to have some designated times where you're fully present. You can even start with just like 10 minutes, you know, especially if you have a very young baby. It's just 10 minutes where you're going to, what I did with when my children were young is I would just put my phone on airplane mode for 10 minutes and just know that they were going to be my only thing for those moments, right? So that's like one way. But another thing is to, and what we were going to talk about was how do we build that connection into the routines that we already have?
Yeah. So what does that look like? I mean, we talked a little bit about different parenting styles. Like, is there a way you would describe like a parenting style that actually helps that baby's brain develop?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think I would say responsive, right? Responsive caregiving. So we're really talking about, again, somebody that's there for the child. It doesn't have to be 100% of the time, but we want to be responding to the child's cues and needs. And one of the things that we can think about is, and actually, you know, going back to those orphanage in Europe. So Anne Pinkley was what ended up founding the Rye method, because what she told all of the nurses was when you're changing their diapers and when you're feeding them, I want you to pick them up. And they said, oh, I can't, they'll attach me. And she said, they need to attach to you, but I might not be here tomorrow, or I might not be able, it doesn't matter. They need to attach to someone. So they didn't have time to change anything else. The ratios were horribly tragic at that time. But she said, when you're feeding them, talk to them. You know, like you said, am I important to this person who's taking care of my need? That's like a very, when you think about, you know, yourself as an elderly person and somebody has to start to wash you or change you or dress you, you know, do you want somebody that's really distracted and not talking to you? Or do you want someone that's acknowledging your dignity and human person, right? And telling you, all right, Sarah, we're going to have to change you now. You know, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to do that. Okay, this is, you know, you want to be acknowledged, right? That same thing. So in the video that we have on the Famfly courses, we actually have a video of myself changing my daughter, who's now 11, when she was just a few months old. And one of the things that I learned from the Rye method, and I'm not saying that you need to follow Rye to a T to have optimal brain development. There's lots of ways that you could get to optimal brain development. The basic fundamental way would be to be responsive and to be in tune with your child. You know, and this could be multiple people, right? It could be you for a certain part of the day, and then it could be a nanny or daycare provider. But you want to make sure that they are seeing your child, they are responding to your child. Those are really important pieces to look for. And so, but a diaper change can be a great way. And maybe that's like kind of a way to end with this example of just the serve and return potential of a diaper change is exponential. So the baby is going to start by probably not always being wanting to be put on their back, right? So you can start by saying something like, I'm going to go ahead and put you on your back. I know sometimes that's hard for you, but mama's here. I'm going to be here for you during that time. Then the baby may look at you and you can say, yeah, I'm here, right? So you're face to face with a baby during a diaper change. So there's eye contact, there's already touch. So why not ritualize it, right? So then instead of just putting, you know, then starting to undress them and start taking off the diaper straps, let them know, say, okay, I'm going to undo the buttons now. Okay, let's count them together. One button, two button, three button. And we should say another really important thing that I want to make sure you're aware of is that no, a baby doesn't need to know how to count. They don't need to know their colors. They don't need to know their animal sounds. They don't need to know any of that. And they don't need fancy toys.
Oh, I was going to ask you that. What educational toys do you recommend?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of great educational toys out there. And if they help you to sort of just connect and explore with your child, then 100% sure, right? But do you need anything? Absolutely 100% no. There is no research that shows any connection with any specific product or, you know, program or even music, you know, believe it or not, there's really not much of a connection. In utero, there's more of a connection with music, interestingly. But yeah, there's nothing that you need to purchase or buy. They could be pointing at a box. They could be pointing at a hair tie. They can be, you know, it's about the richness of that relationship and that connection. But yeah, there are a lot of interesting kind of toys out there now. And if they help you connect, if the counting the buttons is more about the connecting with the child. But cerebral brain development, so numbers, colors, letters, all of that, learning to read, learning to count, all of that will really start to be important 3+. And we know that at 3, that's when the first cerebral brain starts to really come online and be wired. Not that it doesn't exist before that, but at 3 is when that starts to say, okay, what was my potential? What happened in that limbic brain? How many synaptic connections do I have? With those, I can now build my higher brain. And so it's really not until 3, and then, you know, essentially till the end of life, you know, we can always learn something new. But what we can't do is we can't go back in time and wire that limbic brain. We can't increase the density of that limbic brain past those 3 years. And again, now we're learning that foundation of the limbic brain is even formed in that first year. So the more connection, the more we're able to respond and talk, you know, you hear a talk, sing, read, right? You hear these things because those are serve and return interactions, right? When we talk to our babies, when they go, gah, and we go, gah, right? That's a serve and return. When they lift up their leg at a diaper change and we say, oh, thank you. You lifted up your leg for me. That makes it easier for me to change your diaper. Oh, okay. I'm going to lift up your other leg. Okay. I'm going to undo your strap. And you're making eye contact and you're telling them that they're seen, that they're important, that they're heard. All of those are going to build the brain. But again, the density, we're talking about limbic density. Limbic density is built through a non-toxic, stressful environment and rich relational environments. So that's really it, you know? And again, it's actually kind of, I know it can feel kind of overwhelming on the one hand to be like, oh my gosh, you know, I have to do all of what in the first year, but really someone just needs to be there. That's what it is. It's about emotional presence. And again, doesn't have to be all the time. Doesn't have to be every moment of every day. It's really important to take breaks. It's really important to get the care that you need. But overall, you can kind of think about, is my child growing up in a rich relational environment? Do they feel connected? Do they feel safe? Do they feel loved? Those are kind of just the basics.
Oh, thank you so much, Rebecca. I love the summary there at the end, especially how you're talking about that really it comes down to you, you as the caregiver. You don't need fancy toys. You don't need to be 24/7 thinking it cerebrally yourself about all these things you need to do. It's really just be there, be present. And to a degree, that's also following your own instincts. We have a whole episode talking about self-trust, and that's about listening to your inner voice. And I have to connect that to some of the things you were saying earlier around the importance of self-care and the importance of being responsive. So if you know how to be responsive to yourself as an adult and listening to your own feelings, that's huge. And that's also something that is what I'm hearing from you, highly, highly relevant and important for showing that as an example to your child, to show them that they can listen to their voice, express their needs, express their interests, and that those are worthy of interaction and respect.
Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, like you said, feeling like you don't have to overthink it in this first year, right? Knowing that you don't have to overthink, knowing that you can just be present and be there. And that is 100%. Your baby is going to be miles and miles ahead if they have somebody or a few people that are 100% there for them and connected with them. And they have time on their own. They have time to kind of work through stress sometimes. That's totally fine. But overall, do they have somebody that's there for them? Yeah, you don't have to overthink it. You can't spoil a baby, right? You hear that? It's 100% true from a developmental perspective. What that baby needs is just unconditional love. During that first year, really trusting your voice, trusting that you are enough, that connection is 100% enough. Such a beautiful, beautiful thing to leave on.
I love that. So we've mentioned Famfully a few times. I'm going to now talk about Famfully more directly. It is a site that you can go to, famfully.com. It is like masterclass for parenting classes. They have a pregnancy collection, so from free breastfeeding classes to childbirth and infant CPR, a baby collection, which is the first year of parenting, the topic, our topic today, in fact, and choosing the childcare, things like that. And then also another section for a toddler collection, parenting a toddler, potty training, other toddler questions and categories like that. So if you are interested in hearing more from Rebecca, a lot of her courses are there on Famfully. You can go to Famfully and use the code FORTH, F-O-U-R-T-H, spelled out, and have 20% off there. So again, go to Famfully.com and use the code FORTH, F-O-U-R-T-H, for 20% off all of the classes when you sign up. And then you can also visit Early Childhood Matters if you want to go and visit Rebecca in person and take some of her courses, any of her education courses, any of her mom groups, which I highly recommend from firsthand experience, and you're here in the Bay Area, you can go to her site and use that same code FORTH, F-O-U-R-T-H, and have 20% off on Early Childhood Matters as well. So yes, we will wrap here. Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Thank you. And thank you again for the work that you're doing to support families in these early months.
You can subscribe to this podcast in order to hear more from us. Thank you for listening, everyone, and I hope you'll join us next time on the fourth trimester. The theme music on this podcast was created by Sean Trott. Hear more at soundcloud.com/SeanTrott. Special thanks to my true loves, my husband Ben, daughter Penelope, and baby girl Evelyn. Don't forget to share the fourth trimester podcast with any new and expecting parents. I'm Sarah Trott. Goodbye for now.
Hello again, Bicycle Man. I know you're doing all that you can. I wrote the song, simple and true. I wrote the song, I'll sing a song for you. You got your wheels, you got your gears, you ride around town without any fear. You got your pedals, you got your brakes, you always wear your helmet for safety's sake. Hello again, bicycle man. I know you're doing all that you can. I wrote the song, simple and true. I wrote the song, I sing a song for you. Hello again, bicycle man. I know you're doing the best that you can. I wrote the song, simple and true. I wrote the song, I sing a song for you.